Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from New York City, and I welcome you. Today, we're going to learn about how a higher plasma antioxidant level is helpful for pancreatic cancer risk. Where does Coke belong and thrive? Well, this person says in the toilet. Eating fresh fruits every day could reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease by up to 40%. Can losing sleep decrease your brain volume? Yes, according to research at Oxford University, and a lot more on health and healing. Then we're going to examine, the U.S. is now a third world country. Eric Zeus. That's right. If you could imagine 4.3% of the American population lives on how much per day? Very little, I'll tell you. Why doctors are sick of their profession, an interesting piece from a physician. We're also going to look at U.S. college students and debt and give you information you did not know and why we as a nation and students in particular should lobby our Congress to say, rewrite the rules. They're wrong. So we'll give you that. Also, staggeringly high and shockingly underreported rate of white-on-white murder from Janet Olin of Alternet. We'll talk also today about the most evil medical experiments conducted in history by Larry Schwartz. And you may think you have nothing to hide, but you're still breaking laws, which government spying could discover and use against you. I will be taking calls later in the program. Plus today, you want to hear a good debate? You've got it. On the one side is a person speaking on behalf of Monsanto and the genetic engineering industry. On the other side is a 14-year-old young girl, talking about why she's opposed to GMOs. Let's see who wins this debate. It's about 11 minutes long. Let's begin. A lot of people are having trouble sleeping today, and we know why. Because we eat before we go to bed. That's not good. That keeps us awake. We drink before we go to bed. That also is not good. Any sugar in the evening will cause your blood sugar to spike, and that keeps you awake. We don't sleep in dark rooms. We don't sleep in sound, quiet places. We like to keep the radio on or television on, headsets on. We have electromagnetic pulses going into our brain. We're up too late on the computers. We're texting people. If you're the average person, you're texting and looking at your emails constantly. Hence, we don't get a good night's sleep. Here's what can happen according to University of Oxford, published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurology. Quote, it is likely that at some point most of us have experienced a sleepless night. When sleep is cut short, the body is unable to complete all the steps necessary to repair muscles, consolidate memory, and release hormones that regulate growth and appetite. But it goes further. Sleep difficulties are now linked to faster brain volume decline. And that is not good. That means your brain is shrinking. And that can cause memory problems, cognitive problems. So get a good night's sleep and keep your brain healthy. Eating fresh fruits every day, quote, could reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease by up to 40%. This is also from Oxford University in England. Now, we know in the United States that about 600,000 people die from heart disease, another 130,000 from stroke. But a new study finds that the risk of developing cardiovascular disease could be reduced by 40% by simply eating fresh fruits every day. This was done and published in the European Society of Cardiology. They looked at 451,000 individuals from 5 rural and 5 urban centers, and they looked at the diet, and this is what they came up with. Quote, the more fruit consumed each day, the lower the risk of cardiovascular disease. And there was a 7-year follow-up. Now, here's my analysis of this. And by the way, if you want to watch today's program, just go to Ustream channel and then search for Gary Null. We do not consume organic fruit unless you're into organic. We don't consume a lot of fresh organic juices, though you wouldn't know that if you lived on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, because two new juice bars just opened up within 4 blocks of each other, and they're both doing very well. And there's actually 6 juice bars within 8 blocks, just on Broadway. But keep in mind, from 116th Street at Columbia University to 57th Street, from the Hudson River to Central Park, that one block there of people is the highest concentration of wealth, educated people, professionals, lawyers, doctors, engineers, professors, artists in the world. And hence, it can be very deceptive living in an insulated environment unless you get out into the world, or unless you're worldly enough to want to know what's going on outside of that area. But a lot of people don't. They stay in their neighborhoods. One of those unique phenomena. And so you disconnect from people. You think it's normal to have 7 vegetarian restaurants in 8 blocks. There are. It's not. I've seen whole cities in America where there's not even one vegetarian restaurant. And what passes as a vegetarian restaurant really isn't. But that's not true in Manhattan. So we're not eating our fruits. And we should be. What I have found is that the more berries, specifically berries and apples, that a person eats, the more they're able to repair their DNA. And the healthier your DNA, the longer your cells live. You're also able to take people who were smokers or drinkers or did drugs in college or high school, but maybe they haven't smoked anything in 10 years, drank anything in 20 years. That doesn't mean that the disease that would come from doing that is not going to happen. It means that just you have a grace period. There'll be a period of time where you think everything's all right, and then boom, down comes the cancer. Well, if you have fruits, specifically berries or grapes or cherries, and you have a lot of them, they're low in calories, they're good for people who are diabetic, pre-diabetic, they don't fluctuate your blood sugar up and down, they're rich in a whole assortment of flavonoids and polyphenols, and resveratrol, antioxidants. This literally repairs the DNA, especially if you're also juicing. Now, if you're juicing, you can then double the impact. If you're taking compounding powders, fruit powders, you're quadrupling the impact to the good. Then ask yourself, how often do you actually count how many fruits you have in a day? Most people would be lucky to have one fruit in a day. And more often than not, it's not organic. And if they have orange juice, it's generally pasteurized orange juice. No, the orange juice you want shouldn't be pasteurized. You should make it yourself. And that's the best way of having it. Just as I've said many times, cut the skin on apples, 5 or 6 apples, put them in a blender, put in some chia seeds and walnuts, or pistachio nuts and almonds or macadamia nuts or Brazil nuts. Put in some of the flaxseed oil and then add in a couple pints of berries. Add in some quality protein powder. Blend that up and you've got a delicious smoothie that you can have for both breakfast and later on in the morning. Now the berries in there are going to help your eyes, your brain. It'll help reduce the plaque that is built up in your arteries, especially the carotid arteries. The arteries that go up that feed blood to the brain. And those can be highly occluded and you not even know it. And that causes stroke. Because if any of that occluded material breaks off, and it can, then that creates a clot. And the clot then blocks blood flow to the brain and you end up with an ischemic episode. So berries help detoxify along with greens. Greens are the great cleansers and chelators. So if you want to get the plaque out and the heavy metals out, the lead, the cadmium, the mercury, you have your green vegetables and green juices. If you want to repair your DNA, help repair yourself, you have your fruits. So that's why it's so important. Well, this is from Prevent Disease. The phosphoric acid in Coke has an immediate effect on the body, which triggers a tiny inflammatory cascade, which results in the irritability of the esophagus and the blood vessels. Now, a good example of how effective Coke is at literally cutting through surfaces, there's a video that gives a good idea of how Coke behaves as a cleaning agent. Therefore, fine, as a cleaning agent, I have no problem. So there are five things Coke does to the body. One, it causes mechanical damage to cells, which is a huge risk factor for cancer. It's why asbestos particles, for example, cause lung cancer. Two, it causes acid reflux, stomach acid rising up past the esophagus level. And this is more pronounced when the body is horizontal, meaning as in sleeping or laying down, but the sheer volume of Coke and soft drinks consumed in the U.S. means that acid reflux is well past the danger point, in my opinion. Another time you ingest a gassy drink, you're going to get belching and acid in the esophagus. So then that you have to ask yourself, well, how much is too much? The research doesn't say where the limit is. It only shows that most of us are, if we consume it, far past it. Also, stomach acid dissolves tissue, and that's its purpose. The stomach lining does not extend into the esophagus, so the lower esophagus gets damaged by acid far more frequently in soft drinks users than in non-soft drink users, and the result is a radical increase in cell mutations, along with far higher levels of free radicals. And the carbonation irritates the stomach. The stomach then tries to deal with this irritation, and the only way it knows, it adds the only antacid at its disposal, calcium. It gets its calcium from your blood. The blood, now low on calcium, replenishes its supply from the bones. If it does not do this, muscular and brain function could be impaired. Now, phosphoric acid reduces the calcium in the bones. Binding calcium with other materials, such as phosphorus, creates insoluble compounds that are poorly absorbed. And phosphoric acid, used in most soft drinks, provides that, well, let's say, call it the kick, which powerfully binds to calcium in the intestinal tract, forming calcium phosphates. So what the body does is pull the calcium from the bones and other tissues in order to buffer the calcium in the blood, and that can lead to osteoporosis. So that's what it does. But again, I'm not telling you don't buy Coke, because there's some other things. There's uses for Coke where, not in the human body, but elsewhere. All right, the amount of acid in soda is enough to wear away an enamel on your teeth, making them more susceptible to decay. And it's got a very low pH, 2.5. Wow. You know, and pure water is around 7. And we need around 7.2 to 7.6 pH. But here's what Coke could do that would make it something you should consider. It removes grease stains from clothing and fabric. It removes rust, as I mentioned a little while ago. And try this yourself. Include using a fabric dipped in Coke and a sponge or even a foil. It removes blood stains from clothing and fabric. It can clean oil stains from a garage floor and let it stain, soak, and then hose it off. It can kill slugs and snails. Remember, acid kills them. It cleans burnt pans, let them soak in the Coke, then rinse. And it cleans car battery terminals by pouring a small amount over each one. And it makes pennies shine. All right, it cleans tile grout. And it dissolves a lot of other things in the way of stains. So that's that. Now, if you have a higher overall antioxidant level, that's been associated with a lower pancreatic cancer risk, and that's good. This is from the International Journal of Cancer, and it suggests that a protective effect for higher antioxidant levels against the risk of cancer of the pancreas, the fourth most common cause of cancer death in the United States. And this was a part of the European Prospective Investigation into Cancer Nutrition study. And they looked at the antioxidants and said, if you have lutein, lycopene, retinol, vitamin C, tocotrienols, tocopherols, that you have a substantially less likelihood of having pancreatic cancer. And that's a good, good thing. I'm Gary Nall. I'd like to welcome you all from around the world. More and more people tuning in. We're visited by almost 2.5 million people per day. So we thank you. Several things, and I'm going to ask for your feedback, please, in our talkback segment. I want to share with you, let us be honest, college students and graduates around the nation are buried in debt and trying to succeed in an extremely difficult and competitive economic environment. And many people are graduating only to find out that they are unable to get jobs that they want or are trained in. And whether it be due to the small amount of available jobs or more usually the problem of experience. Thus, they have the education, but they don't have the experience, and thus are reducing to have to work menial jobs while paying back exorbitant loans. This is inhumane to the students and their families. So far, I have seen no legislation that has been passed to aid the students in paying back their loans by dropping down the interest and taking away all of the penalties. The situation goes deeper and in part lies at the feet of a little-known institution. This is just one of the most nefarious groups. You've got to put this right up there with Monsanto, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, all corporate Democrats, all corporate Republicans, most police officers. Just put them all in one side of the world saying, man, you're all screwed up. You're dysfunctional. You're like a group of sociopaths trying to have a party with blindfolders on. You're just clueless about what the world actually needs or people need to live long, happy lives or live in coexistence. This is the American Bankers Association. They're a $14 trillion banking industry. And they employ 2 million people. And while it's quite obvious that the American Banking Association is an organization that works in the interest of the bankers, they have an interesting history with regards to student loans. Here's the story that you have not been told. First of all, the American Bankers Association has fought brilliantly against the student interest. They don't like you. They mock you. They ridicule you. They hope that you screw up. Their war against students started in the mid-1960s with the rise of the Johnson administration, and Johnson ordered the formation of a task force to examine the role of the federal government in higher education, specifically student aid. He wanted a man named John W. Gardner to head it. And what they said was this, quote, of the students who did not attend college and who had families who could contribute only $300 or less to their education, about 75% of the men and 55% of the women indicated they would have attended college if they had had more money available. What Johnson saw, this is a loss of human capital and wanted to remedy this, and ultimately signed the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 1965 into law. Now, the law included many suggestions from the Gardner Task Force, such as that the government should aid students monetarily via grants and loans, as well as creating special programs for college-aspiring low-income students. However, this was a major problem for the American Bankers Association. The organization was worried about government encroachment on their business, specifically loans, and argued that the federal government could not replicate the working relationship that locally owned financial institutions had with state and private nonprofit guarantee programs, and that the federal government would end up taking over the industry because there would be very little incentive for the state and private nonprofit agencies to establish their own programs. In order to placate the bankers, President Johnson had told them that the government would be the ultimate loan guarantor if no one else was available. Yet in the present day, the American Bankers Association is without a doubt waging a quiet war on students by actively combating virtually any legislation that would ease their burden of debt. With regards to being able to get rid of student loans and bankruptcy, the American Bank Association stated in 2012 that if allowed to go into effect, quote, it would tempt students to rack up big debt that they wouldn't pay and that the bankruptcy system would be open to abuse. Well, that's rather ironic, accusing that students will engage in irresponsible lending, even though the banks themselves, all of them, engaged in massive amounts of exactly the same activity by giving mortgage loans to people they knew couldn't repay them. The assumption that students would just borrow money and then declare bankruptcy is rather ridiculous, as filing bankruptcy has severe negative effects, such as negative effects on your credit and your future ability to use money, and can prevent you from obtaining new lines of credit and even cause problems when you apply for jobs. Yet, due to the bankers and other groups fighting against being able to get rid of student loans and bankruptcy, the only option is default, which works quite well for the banks. When a person defaults on their student loans, a number of effects occur. Did you know, for example, that if you stop paying your student loan, your entire loan balance will be due full immediately? Collection fees can be added and will be to your outstanding balance. Up to 15% of your paychecks can be taken. Your Social Security and disability income and state federal tax refunds could be seized. You'll lose eligibility for federal aid, including Pell Grants. You'll lose deferment or forbearance options. Outstanding fees and unpaid interest can be capitalized, meaning added on to your principal balance. And these are horrible for any student borrower or the parents or grandparents that co-sign on the loan. They work quite well for the banks because they're going to get their money back no matter what, because it's guaranteed by the government. So your entire economic future has pretty much been destroyed. Well, that's just the cost of doing business. But the American Bankers Association has recently fought against efforts to not have the interest rate on the student loans double from 3.4 to 6.8. The bill in question was Senate Bill 2343, also known as the Stop the Student Loan Interest Rate Hike of 2012. Democrats wanted to finance the bill by closing a tax loophole in which wealthy individuals and large corporations would often file using subchapter S companies to dodge paying employment taxes. The American Bankers Association and other business groups, such as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, financing of the bill on the grounds that it would make tax collection less enforceable than current law and would do little to increase compliance. Republicans, with some Democrats' support, effectively shut down the bill, and thus student loan rates have now doubled. Doubled. And while many have accused the American Bank Association of having a major sway with Republicans, a report from the Congressional Campaign for America's Future entitled Money Changers in the Senate noted that, quote, six Democratic senators, including Blanche Lincoln, Mark Warner, Tom Carper, Ben Nelson, Bill Nelson, and Jim Webb, sent a letter to the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid to make him aware of their concern about reform efforts to aid students and urging consideration of potential alternative legislative proposals. Essentially, these corporate Democrats were bought and paid for by lending companies, were urging that Harry Reid abandon legislation that could aid students and instead look for supposed alternatives which would not harm the banks. Yet what is interesting is that the student loan companies all have close ties to each other and each of these senators, such as Blanche Lincoln's former chief of staff worked as a lobbyist for the student loan industry, and Ben Nelson's former legislative director being a lobbyist for Nelnet, a major student lender. It must be noted this campaign against student loan reform has massive amounts of money on the line. From that previously cited report, it was stated that Nelnet posted profits of $139 million in 1 year, and so it goes. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that the government would save $68 billion if it switched over to direct lending. However, now $68 billion was subsidized private lenders like Sallie Mae to pay their executives exorbitant salaries and bonuses. And Sallie Mae chairman Albert Lord, who raked in over $225 million during his tenure at Sallie Mae. Could you imagine it? $225 million that government-backed Sallie Mae paid a guy? Yeah, well, that's the case. So the students are getting screwed royally. There is no help in sight. The American Bankers Association is going to fight on behalf of its profits, and it knows all the legislators that if it put money in their campaign, they'll buy their vote. So that's why we have students who now are realizing that if they can't pay their loan, first of all, and I'm going to deal with this next week, they could go to jail. There's private debtors prisons now in 27 states, and it's growing. Secondly, a SWAT team, and there were 80,000 SWAT team raised last year, SWAT teams came to one person's home in California, burst in the door, and all to arrest a woman who wasn't there because she was late in her student payments. This is what we've come to. So there's only one way to deal with this, and that is to demand a total, complete reform. Give student loans at 1% interest and no compounding it, and give them bankruptcy option outs. Secondly, why don't you look at Norway and some other countries that allow all students to go to school for free? And that's true in most of the developed countries of the world, except the United States. And why don't you also look at why does it cost so much money to go to these schools? And then you'll see, it is the profit of the people running these schools. $1 million salaries for the presidents of universities is not uncommon. So we've just made education one more commodity, and students, unfortunately, are being victimized. It's not fair to them. It's not fair to their families, especially when we don't have jobs for 55% of all college graduates today, either at the level of their education or anything associated with their education, which means that about 55% of all kids would have benefited themselves by not going to college. I'm telling people right now, and I will show this to be accurate, I believe that right now, unless you're going into a very specific field that is guaranteeing you an income and you have ways of paying it back in a reasonable period of time, and reasonable to me is about maximum 10 years, then you shouldn't go to college at all. It is a game. It's like the American dream. It never was a dream. It was a con job. The dream was to buy real estate. And because that benefited the bankers and it caused the gross domestic product to increase, and then all the things you had to do once you bought the house, the taxes, the local state taxes, and the insurance, everybody profited, the different groups that would come in and fix it up and leasehold maintenance or build it. No, that's not a dream. Health, freedom, happiness, and enjoying life, that's a dream. And we've kept people from being able to enjoy that dream because now they're in this debt cycle. So the fact that not everyone should be going to college. Instead, I would choose, if I were doing it all over today, knowing how difficult it is in the health field, there are tens of thousands of unemployed nutritionists out there. Learn crafts and skills that you can use and barter fair exchange, because that's the future for those who have those skills. They'll be far more likely to be able to have a sustainable life and a quality of life. But we're not telling people to skip college. We're saying it's your only out of poverty. And there was a time when that was true. And for those who are knowing what they're going to get or can afford an education, fine. But then look at who pays for the education. The student, yes, but also their parents, because someone has to co-sign on all those loans. And that can be crippling to them. How bad is it out there? Here's the latest from Eric Suess. 4.3% of Americans survive on less than $2 a day. Let me repeat that. Slightly more than one American household with children in every 25 is surviving on less than $2 a day. That's a lot of people. These figures come from the Social Science Review, and they looked at, you know, we're talking about millions of people here. And this was based upon the World Bank's key indicators of global poverty. quote, $2 a day per person. The World Bank does not release official estimates for the United States, but we have those estimates. Here's the conclusion. Quote, 1.65 million households that have 3.55 million children are surviving on less than $2 a day or less in cash income per person per day in a given month. Households in extreme poverty contribute 4.3% of all non-elderly households with children. The prevalence of extreme poverty rose sharply between 1996 and 2011, with the highest growth rate among groups most affected by the 1996 welfare reform. Thank you, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and all the corporate Democrats. You gutted that provision, but no one's looking at what it means to be any of the 3.55 million children living on less than $2 a day. That's their official report. But you all don't see those people. And as long as we don't see them, we don't think it exists. It does. I filmed them in the new documentary that hopefully will be ready to air in 2 months on poverty in the United States. So right now, we can officially say that over 4.5% of American households, and you got to figure there's about four persons per household. So we're dealing in tens of millions of people live in abject poverty, the likes you would find in a third world nation, under $2 a day. This is from Sandeep Jahar of the Wall Street Journal, why doctors are sick of their profession. Quote, all too often these days I find myself fidgeting by the doorway to my exam room, trying to conclude an office visit with one of my patients. When I look at my career at midlife, I realize that in many ways I have become a kind of doctor I never thought I would be, impatient, occasionally indifferent, at times dismissive or paternalistic. Many of my colleagues are similarly struggling with the loss of their professional ideals. It could be just a little midlife crisis, but it occurs to me that my profession is in a sort of midlife crisis of its own. In the past four decades, American doctors have lost the status they used to enjoy. In the mid-20th century, physicians were the pillars of any community. If you were smart and sincere and ambitious at the top of your class, there was nothing nobler or more rewarding than to aspire to become a physician. Today, medicine is just another profession, and doctors have become, like everyone else, insecure, disconnected, and anxious about the future. In surveys, a majority of doctors express diminished enthusiasm for medicine and say they would discourage a friend or family member from entering the profession. One survey showed 12,000 physicians showed only 6% described their morale is positive. 84% said that their incomes were constant or decreasing. Most said that they didn't have enough time to spend with patients because of paperwork, and nearly half said they planned to reduce the number of patients they would see in the next 3 years or stop practicing medicine altogether. American doctors are suffering from a collective malaise. We strove, made sacrifices, and for what? For many of us, the job has become only that, a job. That attitude isn't just a problem for doctors. It hurt patients, too. And then goes on to talk about that there's 270,000 physicians that are part of this CIRMO, an online community. And here's one of them said that represented a lot. Quote, I wouldn't do it again, and it has nothing to do with the money. I get too little respect from patients, physician colleagues, and administrators. Despite good clinical judgment, hard work, and compassion for my patients, working up patients in the ER these days involves shotgunning multiple unnecessary tests. Everybody gets a CAT scan, despite the fact that we know that they don't need them, and being aware of the wastefulness of it all really sucks the life out of what you do. I feel like a pawn in a money-making game for hospital administrators. There are so many other ways I could have made my living and been more fulfilling. The sad part is we chose medicine because we thought it would be worthwhile and noble. And from what I've seen in my short career, it's a charade. So the discontent is alarming. But how did we get to this point? Well, doctors themselves are at fault. And I think we all know why. I've reported on it 1,000 times on this program and in my paper, Death by Medicine. Time for Talk Back, your opportunity to call in and share insights, comments, and points of view. Give us a call at 888-874-4888. Now, I'm going to play you a part of this debate, and then we'll take your calls after this. This is between a 14-year-old girl and a supporter of Monsanto. Let's take a listen. I think you'll find it interesting.
That was 14-year-old Rachel Parent throwing down the gauntlet to Kevin. The teen activist is passionate about genetically modified food and, as you just heard, takes issue with a lot of things Kevin has to say on the subject, including a show that we did some time ago. Rachel's an activist and the founder of Kids Right to Know. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me here today.
I want to start with how you came to be passionate about this. What was it about GMO that actually drew you in the first place?
Well, originally I had to do a speech for my school, and I really wasn't sure what to do it on. So I was researching these different topics, and I realized that GMOs actually affected everything. So I decided to go with GMOs and researched it more and more, and then eventually I just got so into it protesting and got so into it I started doing speeches for other people.
Who are the other people you're doing speeches for?
I actually go to schools, and I also do speeches at protests and different conferences as well.
Are your parents involved? Is it something that they supported, or was this something that you did all on your own?
I did it, but they support me completely.
Yeah.
You know what a lobbyist is, right?
Yes.
Somebody, okay. Do you think you're a lobbyist for the movement that's against genetically modified foods? Would you call yourself that?
No, I don't think so. And I think that I'm just a part of that movement. And I feel like I'm, like, supporting the youth, really.
And why, when you say Kids Right to Know, why do you feel it's important? I mean, this is obviously an issue that's a political hot button, right? It's a fight in places like Europe, keeping the foods out of places, labeling them in America. It's all over the place. Why do kids in particular, in your view, need to have an awareness of this?
For sure. I believe it's our future, after all. I mean, if you're going to do something to our food, we should definitely know about it. And we're the ones who might have to live with these consequences. So why not be informed about it?
Do you make the assumption right out of the gate that all kids your age believe that this is a bad thing to experiment with foods to make them better or worse? Is this something that you think everybody thinks is bad?
Not necessarily, but I believe that everyone has the right to know what's in their food. And that's exactly why my whole campaign's about. And that's why I just want GMO labeling, and that way people can make informed decisions about what they want to eat.
Do you worry at all about being used? Kevin sort of alluded to this. There are huge lobby groups on either side of this. The companies that make the GMO foods and grains and the rest of it definitely have powerful lobby efforts, but so do the environmentalists and others. Do you worry about being used at all in this fight?
No, because my own cause is different, I believe, because we're just the youth, and we're a complete part of it. But we're separate in a way because we're fighting not only for our food, but for our future and for our nature and our ecosystem. So I believe that we're completely different in a way, but we add to the group.
Okay, let's drill into the issue. Let's say you weren't as lucky as you are, and you were born in an Asian country, you were 14 years old, your only food was rice that had no vitamin A in it. You're going blind and then you died. 550,000 people your age die that way every year. And a company like Monsanto could come along and offer you a genetically modified rice that includes vitamin A that could save your eyesight and your life. How do you feel about that, Rachel?
Actually, funny you mention this. Golden rice was scrapped because it didn't work. And in order for the average 11-year-old boy to get enough vitamin A from rice, he'd have to eat 27 bowls of rice per day. And another thing is, the reason there's blindness isn't because there's a lack of vitamin A in the rice. It's because their diets are simply rice.
Well, that's the problem. You're saying even if he has to eat 30 bowls of rice, there's no vitamin A in what he's eating now. It's not scrapped. It's still being tested. And the bottom line is there'll be other ways to modify food to save people like that. Should we not be trying these things to help those that are dying, or are you against that too?
Should we be messing with Mother Nature?
Well, what do you say to a child your age that's going to die? What do you say?
I mean, in all reality, because golden rice didn't work, how can we fight for that?
And so you don't want to see any attempts to stop food from being destroyed by insects. I mean, what I'm trying to focus you on is there no merits to this at all from your point of view?
My point of view is just that it should be, first of all, tested a lot more. I mean, it's only tested by the very companies that stand to gain by their approval. So I really think that we should have independent studies and then mandatory GMO labeling. That's my thing. That way we can, as consumers, have informed decisions.
Well, there's two debates going on here. One, you want to see labeling. That's one thing. But are you against modifying food at all? Which one?
I know this sounds radical, but yes, I am against genetically modifying our food.
Rachel, I have a problem with that. That may be causing or basically giving a death sentence to millions of people around the world that are not as fortunate as you are.
You know that GMOs actually don't have higher yields either.
Look, the point is to stop experimentation in a science like this that has so much promise could be a huge mistake and effectively be a death sentence for those that need higher yields if they can get them. Plants that are not susceptible to insects and indeed have more vitamins that they need to stay alive with.
And I'm completely, you know what, actually I'm totally fine, and that's completely somebody's decision, whether they want to eat GMOs or not. I'm totally okay with that. So they can keep growing it. That's totally fine. As long as they continue to test and also give us the choice, because it's our right to know.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to let Kevin O'Leary a little bit more. Stay with us after the break. Kevin and Rachel will face off on the issue of genetically modified food. About 90% of all corn, cotton, and soy planted in the U.S. has been genetically modified. The use of these types of seeds around the world is widespread and growing. Proponents say they help farmers plant more with less and ultimately help increase yield to feed the world. Critics say people need more information about food that's been altered for health and safety reasons. Rachel Parent is a teen activist and founder of Kids Right to Know. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
I want to talk about sort of this fine distinction, and Kevin was raising this before, but is it an all or nothing question? Because we, throughout history, whether it's, you know, the breeding of animals or, you know, introducing things like hothouse tomatoes, we do change the way things are grown, and we even change their makeup, their color, their, you know, the content of them. We just do it more slowly outside of a lab. Is there some room to improve things scientifically if we safety test them, if we actually go through the same kind of FDA studies you have to do with a drug?
Well, I think a lot of people also confuse hybridization with GMOs.
Yep.
And just to clarify, GMOs, it's a genetically modified organism, and it's where they take the DNA from a species such as it can be like bacteria, virus, animal, or even from a plant, and they insert it into the DNA of another species to introduce a new trait. For instance, a common trait is pesticide producing. So they'll make the crops pesticide producing, but they haven't adequately tested. And Monsanto's longest study is 90 days. That really doesn't determine how long term it's going to affect our health, the environment, and even our entire ecosystem.
You know, saying Monsanto's testing in 90 days is a little mislabeling it, because many other organizations, including it sounds like some ones you're involved in, do much more testing. So a product comes to market, many people test it, including the government. So Monsanto knows that about food.
Actually, can I just... In Health Canada nor the FDA do any independent studies, and they rely only on the very studies provided by the companies that stand to gain by their approval, like Monsanto.
There's other companies as well, right?
Yes, but they all do their own independent...
Are there organizations on the other side of this debate that do... What would the testing look like? In other words, what kind of testing would be reliable to say this is okay for the environment or the ecosystem?
Definitely, we need a long-term study to determine if it's safe for not only our ecosystem, but our health as well.
Yeah.
Rachel, we're in a long-term study. You're eating genetically modified food, whether you like it or not.
We're the lab rats.
And we have been for decades. And I think what I'm trying to get at about your point of view, and look, everybody has the right to have one, but to say that there's no merit to having science try and make yields better or foods better or help people's problems on a dietary basis sounds a little extreme. And I'm wondering, as time passes, because I have a case study in my own home. I had a daughter your age who, at the same time, she was vehemently opposed to this. She decided to make a documentary film, and she went through the process of researching it. I'm going to show you a clip of it, and she was just like you. She doesn't feel that way today anymore.
You know, actually, Kevin, I have seen this video, and I don't necessarily agree with all the points that are made. And I do have some information that I can share with you after
about it. She went at it from both sides. She didn't make a claim at the beginning that she had a point of view. She said, I'm going to examine both sides. And I wish for you the same thing, because to stay on a point
that... Actually, I have examined both sides, but I choose to follow this side.
And you would prefer to see no more work in GMOs.
Not necessarily this, but I do believe if they're going to work, not only that they have to test it, but at least give us the right to know what's in our food.
Okay, different issue around labeling. I think everybody gets that, and I think the trend in society now is more transparency, and you're going to get labeling. Fine, okay. But I'm trying to explore whether you have any flexibility in your thinking about the merits of science and food. It doesn't sound like you do, and I find that not good, actually.
Actually, you know what? If they want to experiment, okay, but that brings me back to the labeling. At least give us the choice.
The truth is, though, as we know, virtually every product in the grocery store would then be labeled GMO. One danger that you'd face is we would just become immune to that label. We would accept that it's everywhere. As Kevin says, we've been exposed to it for decades, and we'd shrug and say, well, it may be killing the monarch butterflies, but, you know, I've been eating it for 10 years, so I'm not going to stop now. Are you worried about that aspect of this?
Not necessarily, because at least then they have the choice if they want to eat it. But the people like me will find the odd...
Well, we don't really. I mean, I don't have a choice to avoid GMO corn if I live in America, right? Because it is all genetically modified.
It's pretty much all...
So if I'm going to eat corn or any corn-based products or any corn flour or anything that's derived from it, I'm eating this stuff. So that's a pretty tough choice to make.
I mean, there are the odd ones that aren't, and that's why we do want labeling. That way we do know which ones are.
You know, you're very articulate. That's a positive. What I'm concerned about and what I'm exploring with you is whether you've become a shill for a group that wants to use you because you're young, you're articulate, you're getting lots of media, and I'm happy for you on that. But I'm trying to figure out whether you really deep down believe this, that you should stop all scientific approach to looking at food, even if it has long-term benefits down the road for people that really are not as lucky as we are in North America, that don't have access to all the protein we do. That can't be your position. I don't believe it.
It's not necessarily that, and this brings me again back to the labeling, because, I mean, at least test it properly, adequately. That way we know as the consumer if it's safe, and you know what? Okay, whoever wants to eat it or whoever wants to experiment with it, go ahead.
But okay, Rachel, I give you the labeling. Let's say we mandate everything's labeled. Got that. Would you allow companies like Monsanto and many others to try and modify foods to the benefit of all human beings everywhere?
Are you anti-science? Yes or no? Question.
I'm not anti-science, but I'm for responsible science and ethical progress. Science that's proven safe by not the very same companies that stand to gain by their approval.
And I'd like to say we have no evidence, and we may want to withdraw the accusation that you're a shill. What you are is clearly a passionate 14-year-old, and we need more of those
in
the world.
I've always thought that as people age, because you can have a vehement position at one time in your life, but when you start to see the evidence on the other side of it over time, you may change your minds. And from my point of view about you, I hope that happens.
Is that likely to happen, Rachel?
No.
All right. We got to leave it there, but we do appreciate you being here
with us.
Thank you. Rachel Parent.
Brilliant comments. And unfortunately, they didn't bring on Vandana Shiva or Jeffrey Smith, individuals who could have argued about where the malnutrition actually exists and why and how to correct it, and the money we're spending on vaccines instead of on food and proper clean water in those countries, and the fact that you now have insects that are developing an immunity and super weeds, and the research shows these are not abundant crops. So everything we've been told about GMOs are lies, but she nails it one after another. You can watch the full debate on my website and just go to GaryNall.com or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and on my Facebook page, and you'll see that and watch it. Let's say hello to Matt from New York City. Hi, Matt. Your turn.
Barry, it's actually Matt in New York. I love your work, and I hope I can find... You did something so brilliant by bringing us, I think it was Sir Ken Robinson on Tuesday.
Yes.
And is that available on your own?
Yes. Yes. In fact, most people don't know this, but this audience. But we have, just today alone, I put up over 60 different articles and videos. I try to combine the most inspirational ones I can find and love of animals and peaceful ones, but also ones that, hard-hitting ones that show the truth. And they're up there, new ones every single day, 7 days a week. So that's out there also, the whole talk.
I was trying to sleep, but it gave me almost belly laughs. Great. But my question is, and I don't know if you've had a chance to research this, but it seems that ISIL has just sprouted up, you know, full of big weapons and money. And it seems like it's not what it seems. And part of the chatter out there is that there's a coming false flag as we come up on the anniversary of September 11th. So I like your thoughts, and I'll listen over the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Myatt. First, let us understand the genesis. This organization, in no small measure, is our creation, along with the British and the French. We put NATO forces and our troops on the ground, hidden, that's been shown, to train the so-called moderate terrorist in Libya. Libya was not a threat to anyone and had one of the best social systems in Africa, and which people are not aware of. Free education, free medical care. I think it was $36,000 and a home when you get married, and all these wonderful things. Yes, they had this goofball in Gaddafi, but it wasn't a country that was destabilized. Now you have one gigantic open sore with no one running it, and that's where all of these very radical individuals are coming from. Then we take them into Syria, and once again we're wanting to destabilize Syria. For what reason? If we succeed, and if Syria is destroyed in the same way Libya was destroyed, then that only puts Israel and other countries in the area at greater risk, because these people write no rules except their own. And to what good have we done? So we have to pull back and stop listening to the neocons, because the American media today is no different than it was in 2003, banging the wars for greater intervention. We did the same thing with Ukraine, trying to create a false flag there of saying, my God, you know, Russia's invading. Russia didn't invade. Those convoys are filled with weapons. No, Red Cross examined every one of the 280 convoys, and it was with medicine, food to those Russian, to those Ukrainians who wanted to support Russia and were separatists. And instead of acknowledging their pain, suffering, and death, we supported the fascist regime in Ukraine. So right now, people should be aware that there's a great propaganda war going on, and the American public is being not given the full facts and certainly not hearing the voices that could give us a better perspective on this. Thank you very much for sharing your point of view. And we're out of time, and I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen today. I'll look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.